children. She, too, stepped away from the torch. A silent minute passed. Then Delwyn and his wife Lena advanced with their arms around each other. Lena looked at Birgit and said, "I understand your need, sister. We want our vengeance as well, but more than that, we want the rest of our children to be safe. For that reason, we will go too." Several women whose husbands had been slain came forward and agreed with her. The villagers murmured among themselves, then fell silent and motionless. No one seemed willing to address the subject. It was too momentous. Roran understood. He was still trying to digest the implications himself. Finally, Horst strode to the torch and stared with a drawn face into the flame.
"It's no good talking any more. We need time to think. Every man must decide for himself. Tomorrow will be another day. Perhaps things will be clearer then."
He shook his head and lifted the torch, then inverted it and extinguished it against the ground, leaving everyone to find their way home in the moonlight. Roran joined Ulbreich and Baldur, who walked behind their parents at a discreet distance, giving them privacy to talk. Neither of the brothers would look at Roran. Unsettled by their lack of expression, Roran asked, "Do you think anyone else will go? Was that good enough?" Ulbreich emitted a bark of laughter.
"Good enough!"
"Roran," said Baldur in an odd voice, "you could have convinced an Urgal to become a farmer tonight."
"No."
"When you finished, I was ready to grab my spear and dash into the spine after you. I wouldn't have been alone either. The question isn't who will leave, it's who won't. What you said, I've never heard anything like it before." Roran frowned. His goal had been to persuade people to accept his plan, not to get them to follow him personally. "If that's what it takes," he thought with a shrug. Still, the prospect had caught him unawares. At an earlier time, it would have disturbed him. But now he was just thankful for anything that could help him to rescue Katrina and save the villagers. Baldur leaned toward his brother.
"Father would lose most of his tools."
Ulbreich nodded solemnly. Roran knew that smiths made whatever implement was required by the task at hand, and that these custom tools formed a legacy that was bequeathed from father to son, or from master to journeyman. One measure of a smith's wealth and skill was the number of tools he owned. For Horst to surrender his would be no harder than what anyone else has to do, thought Roran. He only regretted that it would entail depriving Ulbreich and Baldur of their rightful inheritance. When they reached the house, Roran retreated to Baldur's room and lay in bed. Through the walls he could still hear the faint sound of Horst and Elaine talking. He fell asleep, imagining similar discussions taking place throughout Carvajal, deciding his and their fate.
Repercussions.
The morning after his speech, Roran looked out his window and saw 12 men leaving Carvajal, heading toward Igawalda Falls. He yawned and limped downstairs to the kitchen. Horst sat alone at the table, twisting a mug of ale in his hands.
"Morning,"
he said. Roran grunted, tore a heel of bread off the loaf on the counter, then seated himself at the opposite end of the table. As he ate, he noted Horst's bloodshot eyes and unkempt beard. Roran guessed that the smith had been awake the entire night. "Do you know why a group is going up?"
"Have to talk with their families," said Horst abruptly. "They've been running into the spine since dawn."
He put the mug down with a crack.
"You have no idea what you did, Roran, by asking us to leave. The whole village is in turmoil. You backed us into a corner with only one way out, your way. Some people hate you for it. Of course, a fair number of them already hated you for bringing this upon us."
The bread in Roran's mouth tasted like sawdust as resentment flared inside him.
"Aragorn was the one who brought back the stone, not me. And the others?"
Horst slipped his ale and grimaced.
"The others adore you. I never thought I would see the day when Garrow's son would stir my heart with words. But you did it, boy, you did it."
He swung a gnarled hand over his head.
"All this, I built it for Elaine and my sons. It took me 7 years to finish. See that beam over the door right there? I broke 3 toes getting that into place. And you know what? I'm going to give it up because of what you said last night.
Roran remained silent. It was what he wanted. Leaving Carvajal was the right thing to do, and since he had committed himself to that course, he saw no reason to torment himself with guilt or regret. The decision is made. I will accept the outcome without complaint, no matter how dire, for this is our only escape from the Empire.
But, said Horst, and leaned forward on one elbow, his black eyes burning beneath his brow. Just you remember that if reality falls short of the airy dreams you conjured, there'll be debts to pay. Give people a hope and then take it away, and they'll destroy you.
The prospect was of no concern to Roran. If we make it to Surda, we will be greeted as heroes by the rebels. If we don't, our deaths will fulfill all debts. When it was clear that the smith had finished, Roran asked, Where is Elaine?
Horst scowled at the change of topic.
Out back.
He stood and straightened his tunic over his heavy shoulders.
I have to go clear out the smithy and decide what tools I'm going to take. I'll hide or destroy the rest. The Empire won't benefit from my work.
I'll help. Roran pushed back his chair.
No,
said Horst roughly.
This is a task I can only do with Albrecht and Baldur. That forge has been my entire life and theirs. You wouldn't be much help with that arm of yours anyway. Stay here. Elaine can use you.
After the smith left, Roran opened the side door and found Elaine talking with Gertrude by the large pile of firewood Horst maintained year-round. The healer went up to Roran and put a hand on his forehead.
Ah, I was afraid that you might have a fever after yesterday's excitement. Your family heals at the most extraordinary rate. I could barely believe my eyes when Aragorn started walking about after having his legs skinned and spending 2 days in bed.
Roran stiffened at the mention of his cousin, but she did not seem to notice.
Let's see how your shoulder is doing, shall we?
Roran bowed his neck so that Gertrude could reach behind him and untie the knot to the wool sling. When it was undone, he carefully lowered his right forearm, which was still immobilized in a splint, until his arm was straight. Gertrude slid her fingers under the poultice packed on his wound and peeled it off.
Oh, my, she said.
A thick, rancid smell clogged the air. Roran clenched his teeth as his gorge rose, then looked down. The skin under the poultice had turned white and spongy, like a giant birthmark of maggot flesh. The bite itself had been stitched up while he was unconscious, so all he saw was a jagged pink line caked with blood on the front of his shoulder. Swelling and inflammation had forced the twisted catgut threads to cut deep into his flesh, while beads of clear liquid oozed from the wound. Gertrude clucked her tongue as she inspected him, then refastened the bandages and looked Roran in the eye.
You're doing well enough, but the tissue may become diseased. I can't tell yet. If it does, we'll have to cauterize your shoulder.
Roran nodded.
Will my arm work once it heals? As long as the muscle knits together properly. It also depends on how you want to use it.
Will I be able to fight?
If you want to fight, said Gertrude slowly, I suggest that you learn to use your left hand.
She patted his cheek, then hurried back toward her hut.
My arm!
Roran stared at his bound limb as if it no longer belonged to him. Until that moment, he had not realized how closely his sense of identity was linked to the condition of his body. Injuring his flesh caused injury to his psyche, as well as the other way around. Roran was proud of his body, and seeing it mutilated sent a jolt of panic through him, especially since the damage was permanent. Even if he regained the use of his arm, he would always bear a thick scar as a memento of his injury. Taking his hand, Elaine led Roran back into the house, where she crumbled mint into a kettle, then set it on the stove to boil.
You really love her, don't you?
What? He looked at her, startled. Elaine rested a hand on her belly.
Katrina, she smiled, I'm not blind. I know what you've done for her, and I'm proud of you. Not every man would go as far.
It won't matter if I can free her.
The kettle began to whistle stridently. You will, I'm sure of it, one way or another.
Elaine poured the tea.
We had better start preparing for the trip. I'm going to sort through the kitchen first. While I do, can you go upstairs and bring me all the clothes, bedding, and anything else you think might be useful?
Where should I put it? Asked Roran.
The dining room will be fine.
Since the mountains were too steep and the forest too dense for wagons, Roran realized that their supplies were limited to however much they could carry themselves, as well as what they could pile onto Horst's two horses, although one of those had to be left partially unburdened so that Elaine could ride whenever the trail proved too strenuous for her pregnancy. Compounding the issue was the fact that some families in Carvajal did not have enough steeds for both provisions and the young, old and infirm who would be unable to keep pace on foot. Everyone would have to share resources. The question, though, was with whom? They still did not know who else was going, besides Birgit and Delwyn. Thus, when Elaine finished packing the items she deemed essential, mainly food and shelter, she sent Roran to find out if anyone needed extra storage space, and if not, if she could borrow some in turn, for there were plenty of non-essential items she wanted to bring, but would otherwise abandon. Despite the people hurrying through the streets, Carvajal was heavy with a forced stillness, an unnatural calm that belied the feverish activity hidden within the houses. Almost everyone was silent and walked with downturned faces, engrossed in their own thoughts. When Roran arrived at Orvel's house, he had to pound on the knocker for almost a minute before the farmer answered the door.
"Oh, it's you, Stronghammer." Orvel stepped out on the porch. "Sorry for the wait, I was busy. How can I help you?"
He tapped a long black pipe against his palm, then began to roll it nervously between his fingers. Inside the house, Roran heard chairs being shoved across the floor and pots and pans banging together. Roran quickly explained Elaine's offer and request. Orvel squinted up at the sky.
"I reckon I've got enough room for my own stuff. Ask around, and if you still need space, I have a pair of oxen that could hold a bit more."
"So you are going?"
Orvel shifted uncomfortably.
"Well, I wouldn't say that. We're just getting ready in case of another attack."
"Ah." Puzzled, Roran trudged onto Kizalt's house. He soon discovered that no one was willing to reveal whether they had decided to leave, even when evidence of their preparations was in plain sight. And they all treated Roran with a deference that he found unsettling. It manifested itself in small gestures, offers of condolences for his misfortune, respectful silence whenever he spoke, and murmurs of assent when he made a statement. It was as if his deeds had inflated his stature and intimidated the people he had known since childhood, distancing him from them. "I am branded," thought Roran, limping through the mud. He stopped at the edge of a puddle and bent to examine his reflection, curious if he could discern what made him so different. He saw a man in ragged, blood-stained clothes, with a humped back and a crooked arm tied across his chest. His neck and cheeks were scumbled with an impending beard, while his hair was matted into snarled ropes that writhed in a halo around his head. Most frightening of all, though, were his eyes, which had sunk deep into the sockets, giving him a haunted appearance. From within those two morbid caverns, his gaze boiled like molten steel, full of loss, rage, and an obsessive craving. A lopsided smile crept across Roran's face, rendering his visage even more shocking. He liked how he looked. It matched his feelings. Now he understood how he had managed to influence the villagers. He bared his teeth. "I can use this image. I can use it to destroy the Razak." Lifting his head, he slouched up the street, pleased with himself. Just then Thane approached him and grasped his left forearm in a hearty grip.
"Stronghammer, you don't know how glad I am to see you."
"You are?"
Roran wondered if the whole world had been turned inside out during the night. Thane nodded vigorously.
Ever since we attacked the soldiers, everything has seemed hopeless to me. It pains me to admit it, but so it was. My heart pounded all the time, like I was about to fall down a well. My hands shook and I felt dreadfully ill. I thought someone had poisoned me. It was worse than death. But what you said yesterday healed me instantly and let me see purpose and meaning in the world again. I can't even explain the horror you saved me from. I am in your debt. If you need or want anything, just ask and I'll help. Moved, Roran gripped the farmer's forearm in return and said, "Thank you, Thane. Thank you." Thane bowed his head, tears in his eyes, then released Roran and left him standing alone in the middle of the street. What have I done? Exodus. A wall of thick, smoky air engulfed Roran as he entered the Seven Sheaves, Morn's tavern. He stopped beneath the Urgelhorns pegged over the door and let his eyes adjust to the dim interior. "Hello?" he called. The door to the back rooms banged open as Tara ploughed forward, trailed by Morn. They both glared sullenly at Roran. Tara planted her meaty fists on her hips and demanded, "What do you want here?" Roran stared at her for a moment, trying to determine the source of her animosity. "Have you decided whether to accompany me into the spine?" "That's none of your business," snapped Tara. "Oh, yes, it is." He restrained himself, though, and instead said, "Whatever your intentions are, if you were to go, Elaine would like to know if you have room in your bags for a few more items, or if you need extra room yourself. She has..." "Extra room?" burst out Morn. He waved at the wall behind the bar, which was lined with oak casks. "I have, packed in straw, 12 barrels of the clearest winter ale, which have been kept at the perfect temperature for the past 5 months. They were Quimby's last batch. What am I supposed to do with them? Or my hogsheads of lager and stout? If I leave them, the soldiers will dispose of it in a week, or they'll spike the barrels and pour the beer into the ground, where the only creatures who'll enjoy it will be grubs and worms."
"Oh!"
Morn sat and wrung his hands, shaking his head. 12 years of work! Ever since Father died, I ran the tavern the same way he did, day in and day out. And then you and Aragorn had to cause this trouble. He stopped, breathing with difficulty, and wiped his mashed face with the edge of his sleeve. "There, there now," said Tara. She put her arm around Morn and jabbed a finger at Roran. "Who gave you the leave to stir up Carver Hall with your fancy words? If we go, how will my poor husband make a living? He can't take his trade with him like Horst or Gedrick. He can't squat in an empty field and farm it like you. Impossible! Everyone will go and we will starve. Or we will go and we will still starve. You have ruined us." Roran looked from her flushed, angry face to Morn's distraught one, then turned and opened the door. He paused on the threshold and said in a low voice, "I have always counted you among my friends. I would not have you killed by the Empire." Stepping outside, he pulled his vest tight around himself and paced away from the tavern, ruminating the whole way. At Fisk's Well he stopped for a drink and found himself joined by Birgit. She watched him struggle to turn the crank with only one hand, then took it from him and brought up the water bucket, which she passed to him without drinking. He sipped the cool liquid, then said, "I'm glad that you are coming." He handed the bucket back. Birgit eyed him. "I recognize the force that drives you, Roran, for it propels me as well. We both wish to find the Razak. Once we do, though, I will have my compensation from you for Quimby's death. Never forget that." She pushed the full bucket back into the well and let it fall unchecked, the crank spinning wildly. A second later, the well echoed with a hollow splash. Roran smiled as he watched her walk away. He was more pleased than upset by her declaration. He knew that even if everyone else in Carver Hall were to forsake the cause or die,
Birgit would still help him to hunt the Razak. Afterward, though, if an afterward existed, he would have to pay her price or kill her. That was the only way to resolve such matters. By evening, Horst and his sons had returned to the house, bearing two small bundles wrapped in oilcloth.
"Is that all?" asked Elaine.
Horst nodded curtly, lay the bundles on the kitchen table, and unwrapped them, to expose four hammers, three tongs, a clamp, a medium-sized bellows, and a 3-pound anvil. As the five of them sat to dinner, Albrecht and Baldur discussed the various people they had seen making covert preparations. Roran listened intently, trying to keep track of who had lent donkeys to whom, who showed no signs of departing, and who might need help to leave.
"The biggest problem," said Baldur, "is food. We can only carry so much, and it'll be difficult to hunt enough in the spine to feed 200 or 300 people." Horst shook his finger, his mouth full of beans, then swallowed. "No, hunting won't work. We have to bring our flocks with us. Combined, we own enough sheep and goats to feed the lot of us for a month or more."
Roran raised his knife. "Wolves!"
"I'm more worried about keeping the animals from wandering off into the forest," replied Horst. "Herding them will be a chore."
Roran spent the following day assisting whomever he could, saying little, and generally allowing people to see him working for the good of the village. Late that night he tumbled into bed, exhausted but hopeful. The advent of dawn pierced Roran's dreams and woke him with a sense of momentous expectation. He stood and tiptoed downstairs, then went outside and stared at the misty mountains, absorbed by the morning silence. His breath formed a white plume in the air, but he felt warm, for his heart throbbed with fear and eagerness. After a subdued breakfast, Horst brought the horses to the front of the house, where Roran helped Albrecht and Baldur load them with saddlebags and other bundles of supplies. Next, Roran took up his own pack, hissing as the leather shoulder strap pressed down on his injury. Horst closed the door to the house. He lingered for a moment with his fingers on the steel doorknob, then took Elaine's hand and said, "Let's go." As they walked through Carverhall, Roran saw somber families gathering by their houses with their piles of possessions and yammering livestock. He saw sheep and dogs with bags tied on their backs, teary-eyed children on donkeys, and makeshift sledges hitched to horses with crates of fluttering chickens hung on each side. He saw the fruits of his success, and he knew not whether to laugh or to cry. They stopped at Carverhall's north end and waited to see who would join them. A minute passed, then Birgit approached from the side, accompanied by Nolfavrel and his younger siblings. Birgit greeted Horst and Elaine and stationed herself nearby. Ridley and his family arrived outside the wall of trees, driving over 100 sheep from the east side of Palancar Valley.
"I figured that it would be better to keep them out of Carverhall," shouted Ridley over the animals.
"Good thinking," replied Horst.
Next came Delwyn, Lena and their 5 children, Orville and his family, Loring with his sons, Kalitha and Thane, who gave Roran a large smile, and then Kizzelt's clan. Those women who had been recently widowed, like Nola, clustered around Birgit. Before the sun had cleared the mountain peaks, most of the village had assembled along the wall. But not all. Morn, Tara, and several others had yet to show themselves, and when Eva arrived, it was without any supplies.
"You're staying," observed Roran.
He sidestepped a knot of testy goats that Gertrude was attempting to restrain.
"Aye," said Eivor, drawing out the word into a weary admission.
He shivered, crossed his bony arms for warmth, and faced the rising sun, lifting his head so as to catch the transparent rays.
"Svart refused to leave. It was like carving against the grain to get him into the spine in the first place. Someone has to look after him, and I don't have any children, so..."
He shrugged.
"Doubt I could give up the farm anyway."
"What will you do when the soldiers arrive?"
"Give them a fight that they'll remember."
Roran laughed hoarsely and clapped Ivar on the arm, doing his best to ignore the unspoken fate that they both knew awaited anyone who remained. A thin, middle-aged man, Ethelbert, marched to the edge of the congregation and shouted, "You're all fools!" With an ominous rustle, people turned to look at their accuser. "I've held my peace throughout this madness, but I'll not follow a nattering lunatic. If you weren't blinded by his words, you'd see that he's leading you to destruction. Well, I won't go. I'll take my chances sneaking past the soldiers and finding refuge in Terransford. They're our own people, at least, not the barbarians you'll find in Surda." He spat on the ground, then spun on his heel and stomped away. Afraid that Ethelbert might convince others to defect, Roran scanned the crowd and was relieved to see nothing more than restless muttering. Still, he did not want to dawdle and give people a chance to change their minds. He asked Horst under his breath, "How long should we wait?"
"Albrecht, you and Baldur run around as fast as you can and check if anyone else is coming. Otherwise, we'll leave."
The brothers dashed off in opposite directions. Half an hour later, Baldur returned with Fisk, Isolde, and their borrowed horse. Leaving her husband, Isolde hurried toward Horst, shooing her hands at anyone who got in her way, oblivious to the fact that most of her hair had escaped imprisonment in its bun and stuck out in odd tufts. She stopped, wheezing for breath.
"I am sorry we're so late, but Fisk had trouble closing up the shop. He couldn't pick which planers or chisels to bring."
She laughed in a shrill note, almost hysterical.
"It was like watching a cat surrounded by mice, trying to decide which one to chase. First this one, then that one."
A wry smile tugged at Horst's lips.
"I understand perfectly."
Roran strained for a glimpse of Albrecht, but to no avail. He gritted his teeth.
"Where is he?"
Horst tapped his shoulder.
"Right over there, I do believe."
Albrecht advanced between the houses with three beer casks tied to his back and an aggrieved look that was comic enough to make Baldur and several others laugh. On either side of Albrecht walked Morn and Tara, who staggered under the weight of their enormous packs, as did the donkey and two goats that they towed behind them. To Roran's astonishment, the animals were burdened with even more casks.
"They won't last a mile," said Roran,
growing angry at the couple's foolishness.
"And they don't have enough food. Do they expect us to feed them, or—"
With a chuckle, Horst cut him off.
"I wouldn't worry about the food. Morn's beer will be good for morale, and that's worth more than a few extra meals, you'll see."
As soon as Albrecht had freed himself of the casks, Roran asked him and his brother,
"Is that everyone?"
When they answered in the affirmative, Roran swore and struck his thigh with a clenched fist. Excluding Ivor, three families were determined to remain in Palancar Valley: Ethelbert's, Parr's, and Knut's.
"I can't force them to come," he sighed.
"All right. There's no sense in waiting longer."
Excitement rippled through the villagers. The moment had finally arrived. Horst and five other men pulled open the wall of trees, then laid planks across the trench so that the people and animals could walk over. Horst gestured.
"I think that you should go first, Roran."
"Wait!"
Fisk ran up and, with evident pride, handed Roran a blackened 6-foot-long staff of hawthorn wood with a knot of polished roots at the top and a blued steel ferrule that tapered into a blunt spike at the base.
"I made it last night," said the carpenter. "I thought that you might have need of it."
Roran ran his left hand over the wood, marvelling at its smoothness.
"I couldn't have asked for anything better. Your skill is masterful. Thank you."
Fisk grinned and backed away. Conscious of the fact that the entire crowd was watching, Roran faced the mountains and the Igawalda Falls. His shoulder throbbed beneath the leather strap. Behind him lay his father's bones and everything he had known in life. Before him, the jagged peaks piled high into the pale sky and blocked his way and his will.
But he would not be denied, and he would not look back. Katrina. Lifting his chin, Roran strode forward. His staff knocked against the hard planks as he crossed the trench and passed out of Carverhall, leading the villagers into the wilderness. On the crags of Telnair. Thud! Bright as a flaming sun, the dragon hung before Aragorn, and everyone clustered along the crags of Telnair, buffeting them with gusts from its mighty wings. The dragon's body appeared to be on fire as the brilliant dawn illuminated its golden scales and sprayed the ground and trees with dazzling chips of light. It was far larger than Saphira, large enough to be several hundred years old, and proportionately thicker in its neck, limbs and tail. Upon its back sat the rider, robes startling white against the brilliance of the scales. Aragorn fell to his knees, his face upturned. I'm not alone. Awe and relief coursed through him. No more would he have to bear the responsibility of the Varden and of Galbatorix by himself. Here was one of the guardians of old, resurrected from the depths of time to guide him, a living symbol and a testament to the legends he had been raised with. Here was his master. Here was a legend. As the dragon turned to land, Aragorn gasped. The creature's left foreleg had been severed by a terrible blow, leaving a helpless white stump in place of the once mighty limb. Tears filled his eyes. A whirlwind of dry twigs and leaves enveloped the hilltop as the dragon settled on the sweet clover and folded its wings. The rider carefully descended from his steed along the dragon's intact front right leg, then approached Aragorn, his hands clasped before him. He was an elf with silver hair, old beyond measure, though the only sign of age was the expression of great compassion and sadness upon his face. Ostato Chetaway, said Aragorn, the morning sage. As you asked, I have come. With a jolt, he remembered his manners and touched his lips. Atra esterni onno Thelduin. The rider smiled. He took Aragorn by the shoulders and lifted him upright, staring at him with such kindness that Aragorn could look at nothing else. He was consumed by the endless depths within the elf's eyes. Oromis is my proper name, Aragorn Shadeslayer. You knew, whispered Islanzadi, with a hurt expression that quickly transformed into a storm of rage. You knew of Aragorn's existence, and yet you did not tell me? Why have you betrayed me, Shuttagal? Oromis released Aragorn from his gaze and transferred it onto the queen. I kept my peace because it was uncertain if Aragorn or Arya would live long enough to come here. I had no wish to give you a fragile hope that might have been torn away at any moment. Islanzadi spun about, her cape of swan feathers billowing like wings. You had no right to withhold such information from me. I could have sent warriors to protect Arya, Aragorn and Saphira in Fardandur and to escort them safely here. Oromis smiled sadly. I hid nothing from you, Islanzadi, but what you had already chosen not to see. If you had scried the land, as is your duty, you would have discerned the source of the chaos that has swept Alagasia, and learned the truth of Arya and Aragorn. That you might forget the Varden and the dwarves in your grief is understandable. But Brom? Vinnar Aelfakin, the last of the elf friends? You have been blind to the world, Islanzadi, and lax upon your throne. I could not risk driving you further away by subjecting you to another loss. Islanzadi's anger drained away, leaving her face pale and her shoulders slumped. I am diminished, she whispered. A cloud of hot, moist air pressed against Aragorn as the gold dragon bent to examine him, with eyes that glittered and sparked.
We are well met, Aragorn Shadeslayer,
I am Glader.
His voice, for it was unmistakably male, rumbled and shook through Aragorn's mind like the growl of a mountain avalanche. All Aragorn could do was touch his lips and say, I am honored. Then Glader brought his attention to bear on Saphira. She remained perfectly still, her neck arched stiffly as Glader sniffed her cheek and along the line of her wing. Aragorn saw Saphira's clenched leg muscles flutter with an involuntary tremor.
You smell of humans,
said Glader.
And all you know of your own race is what your instincts have taught you. But you have the heart of a true dragon.
During this silent exchange, Oric presented himself to Oromis.
Truly this is beyond anything that I dared hope or expect. You are a pleasant surprise in these dark times, Rider.
He clapped his fist over his heart.
If it is not too presumptuous, I would ask a boon on behalf of my king and my clan, as was the custom between our people.
Oromis nodded. And I will grant it if it is within my power.
Then tell me, why have you remained hidden for all these years? You were sorely needed, Arjit Lam.
Ah, said Oromis. Many sorrows exist in this world, and one of the greatest is being unable to help those in pain. I could not risk leaving this sanctuary, for if I had died before one of Galbatorix's eggs had hatched, then there would have been no one to pass on our secrets to the new rider, and it would have been even harder to defeat Galbatorix.
That was your reason? Spat Oric. Those are the words of a coward. The eggs might have never hatched.
Everyone went deathly quiet, except for a faint growl that emanated from between Glader's teeth. If you were not my guest here, said Islanzadi, I would strike you down myself for that insult. Oromis spread his hands.
Nay, I am not offended. It is an apt reaction. Understand, Oric, that Glader and I cannot fight. Glader has his disability, and I,
he touched the side of his head,
am also maimed. The Forsworn broke something within me when I was their captive, and while I can still teach and learn, I can no longer control magic except for the smallest of spells. The power escapes me no matter how much I struggle. I would be worse than useless in battle. I would be a weakness and a liability, one who could easily be captured and used against you. So I removed myself from Galbatorix's influence for the good of the many, even though I yearned to openly oppose him.
The cripple who is whole, murmured Aragorn.
Forgive me,
said Oric. He appeared stricken.
It is of no consequence.
Oromis placed a hand on Aragorn's shoulder.
Islanzadi Drottning, by your leave?
Go, she said wearily. Go and be done with you. Glader crouched low to the ground, and Oromis nimbly climbed up his leg and into the saddle on his back.
Come, Aragorn and Saphira, we have much to talk about.
The gold dragon leaped off the cliff and circled overhead, rising on an updraft. Aragorn and Oric solemnly clasped arms.
Bring honour to your clan, said the dwarf.
As Aragorn mounted Saphira, he felt as if he were about to embark on a long journey and that he should say farewell to those who remained behind. Instead, he just looked at Arya and smiled, letting his wonder and joy show. She half frowned, appearing troubled, but then he was gone, swept into the sky by the eagerness of Saphira's flight. Together, the two dragons followed the white cliff northward for several miles, accompanied only by the sound of their wings. Saphira flew abreast of Glader. Her enthusiasm boiled over into Aragorn's mind, heightening his own emotions. They landed in another clearing, situated on the edge of the cliff, just before the wall of exposed stone crumbled back into the earth. A bare path led from the precipice to the doorstep of a low hut grown between the trunks of four trees, one of which straddled a stream that emerged from the moody depths of the forest. Glader would not fit inside. The hut could have easily sat between his ribs.
"Welcome to my home," said Oromis, as he alighted on the ground with uncommon ease. "I live here on the brink of the crags of Telnair, because it provides me the opportunity to think and study in peace. My mind works better away from Ellesmira and the distractions of other people."
He disappeared inside the hut, then returned with two stools and flagons of clear, cold water for both himself and Eragon. Eragon sipped his drink and admired the spacious view of Duweldenvaren in an attempt to conceal his awe and nervousness while he waited for the elf to speak.
"I am in the presence of another rider."
Beside him, Saphira crouched with her eyes fixed on Glader, slowly kneading the dirt between her claws. The gap in their conversation stretched longer and longer. 10 minutes passed, half an hour, then an hour. It reached the point where Eragon began to measure the elapsed time by the sun's progress. At first his mind buzzed with questions and thoughts, but those eventually subsided into calm acceptance. He enjoyed just observing the day. Only then did Oromis say,
"You have learned the value of patience well. That is good."
It took Eragon a moment to find his voice. "You can't stalk a deer if you're in a hurry." Oromis lowered his flagon.
"True enough. Let me see your hands. I find that they tell me much about a person."
Eragon removed his gloves and allowed the elf to grip his wrists with thin, dry fingers. He examined Eragon's calluses, then said,
"Correct me if I am wrong. You have wielded a scythe and plough more often than a sword, though you are accustomed to a bow."
"Aye."
"And you have done little writing or drawing, maybe none at all."
"Brom taught me my letters in Tirm."
"Beyond your choice of tools, it seems obvious that you tend to be reckless and disregard your own safety."
"What makes you say that, Oromis Elder?" asked Eragon, using the most respectful and formal honorific that he could think of.
"Not Elder," corrected Oromis. "You may call me Master in this tongue, and Ebrethil in the ancient language, nothing else. You will extend the same courtesy to Glader. We are your teachers, you are our students, and you will act with proper respect and deference."
Oromis spoke gently, but with the authority of one who expects absolute obedience.
"Yes, Master Oromis."
"As will you, Saphira."
Eragon could sense how hard it was for Saphira to unbend her pride enough to say,
"Yes, Master."
Oromis nodded.
"Now, anyone with such a collection of scars has either been hopelessly unfortunate, fights like a berserker, or deliberately pursues danger. Do you fight like a berserker?"
"No."
"Nor do you seem unfortunate, quite the opposite. That leaves only one explanation, unless you think differently."
Eragon cast his mind over his experiences at home and on the road in an attempt to categorize his behavior.
"I would say, rather, that once I dedicate myself to a certain project or path, I see it through, no matter the cost, especially if someone I love is in danger."
His gaze flicked toward Saphira.
"And do you undertake challenging projects?"
"I like to be challenged."
"So you feel the need to pit yourself against adversity in order to test your abilities?"
"I enjoy overcoming challenges, but I've faced enough hardship to know that it's foolish to make things more difficult than they are. It's all I can do to survive as it is."
"Yet you chose to follow the Razak when it would have been easier to remain in Palankar Valley. And you came here."
"It was the right thing to do, Master."
For several minutes no one spoke. Eragon tried to guess what the elf was thinking, but could glean no information from his mask-like visage. Finally, Oromis stirred.
"Were you perchance given a trinket of some kind in Tarnag, Eragon?
A piece of jewellery, armour, or even a coin?
Aye.
Aragorn reached inside of his tunic and fished out the necklace with the tiny silver hammer. Ganel made this for me, on Hrothgar's orders, to prevent anyone from scrying Saphira or me. They were afraid that Galbatorix might have discovered what I looked like.
How did you know?
Because, said Oromis, I could no longer sense you.
Someone tried to scry me by Sealthrim about a week ago. Was that you?
Oromis shook his head. After I first scried you with Arya, I had no need to use such crude methods to find you. I could reach out and touch your mind with mine, as I did when you were injured in Farthan Dûr. Lifting the amulet, he murmured several lines in the ancient language, then released it. It contains no other spells I can detect. Keep it with you at all times. It is a valuable gift.
He pressed the tips of his long fingers together, his nails as round and bright as fish scales, and stared between the arches they formed toward the white horizon.
Why are you here, Aragorn?
To complete my training.
And what do you think that process entails?
Aragorn shifted uncomfortably.
Learning more about magic and fighting.
Brom wasn't able to finish teaching me everything that he knew.
Magic, swordsmanship, and other such skills are useless unless you know how and when to apply them. This I will teach you. However, as Galbatorix has demonstrated, power without moral direction is the most dangerous force in the world. My main task, then, is to help you, Aragorn and Saphira, to understand what principles guide you, so that you do not make the right choices for the wrong reasons. You must learn more about yourself, who you are, and what you are capable of doing. That is why you are here.
When do we begin?
Asked Saphira.
Oromis began to answer when he stiffened and dropped his flagon. His face went crimson and his fingers tightened into hooked claws that dragged at his robe like cockleburrs. The change was frightening and instantaneous. Before Aragorn could do more than flinch, the elf had relaxed again, although his entire body now bespoke weariness.
Concerned, Aragorn dared to ask, "Are you well?"
A trace of amusement lifted the corner of Oromis's mouth. "Less so than I might wish. We elves fancy ourselves immortal, but not even we can escape certain maladies of the flesh which are beyond our knowledge of magic to do more than delay. No, do not worry, it isn't contagious, but neither can I rid myself of it." He sighed. "I have spent decades binding myself with hundreds of small, weak spells that, layered one upon another, duplicate the effect of enchantments that are now beyond my reach. I bound myself with them so that I might live long enough to witness the birth of the last dragons and to foster the rider's resurrection from the ruin of our mistakes."
"How long until—"
Oromis lifted a sharp eyebrow. "How long until I die? We have time, but precious little for you or me, especially if the Varden decide to call upon your help. As a result, to answer your question, Saphira, we will begin your instruction immediately, and we will train faster than any rider ever has or ever will, for I must condense decades of knowledge into months and weeks."
"You do know," said Aragorn, struggling against the embarrassment and shame that made his cheeks burn, "about my own infirmity." He ground out the last word, hating the sound of it. "I am as crippled as you are."
Sympathy tempered Oromis's gaze, though his voice was firm. "Aragorn, you are only a cripple if you consider yourself one. I understand how you feel, but you must remain optimistic, for a negative outlook is more of a handicap than any physical injury. I speak from personal experience. Pitying yourself serves neither you nor Saphira. I and the other spellweavers will study your malady to see if we might devise a way to alleviate it. But in the meantime, your training will proceed as if nothing were amiss."
Aragorn's gut clenched and he tasted bile as he considered the implications. "Surely Oromis wouldn't make me endure that torment again. The pain is unbearable. he said frantically. It would kill me.
No, Aragorn, it will not kill you. That much I know about your curse. However, we both have our duty, you to the Varden and I to you. We cannot shirk it for the sake of mere pain. Far too much is at risk, and we can ill afford to fail.
All Aragorn could do was shake his head as panic threatened to overwhelm him. He tried to deny Oromus's words, but their truth was inescapable.
Aragorn, you must accept this burden freely.
Have you no one or nothing that you are willing to sacrifice yourself for? His first thought was of Saphira, but he was not doing this for her, nor for Nasuada, nor even for Arya. What drove him, then? When he had pledged fealty to Nasuada, he had done so for the good of Rohan and the other people trapped within the Empire. But did they mean enough to him to put himself through such anguish? Yes, he decided. Yes, they do, because I am the only one who has a chance to help them, and because I won't be free of Galbatorix's shadow until they are as well, and because this is my only purpose in life. What else would I do? He shuddered as he mouthed the ghastly phrase. I accept on behalf of those I fight for, the people of Alagaesia, of all races, who have suffered from Galbatorix's brutality. No matter the pain, I swear that I will study harder than any student you've had before.
Oromus nodded gravely. I ask for nothing less. He looked at Gleda for a moment, then said, Stand and remove your tunic. Let me see what you are made of.
Wait, said Saphira. Was Brom aware of your existence here, Master?
Aragorn paused, struck by the possibility.
Of course, said Oromus. He was my pupil as a boy in Illyria. I am glad that you gave him a proper burial, for he had a hard life, and few enough ever showed him kindness. I hope that he found peace before he entered the void.
Aragorn slowly frowned. Did you know Morzan as well?
He was my apprentice before Brom.
And Galbatorix?
I was one of the elders who denied him another dragon after his first was killed. But no, I never had the misfortune to teach him. He made sure to personally hunt down and kill each of his mentors.
Aragorn wanted to inquire further, but he knew that it would be better to wait. So he stood and unlaced the top of his tunic. It seems, he said to Saphira, that we will never learn all of Brom's secrets. He shivered as he pulled off the tunic in the cool air, then squared his shoulders and lifted his chest. Oromus circled him, stopping with an astonished exclamation as he saw the scar that crossed Aragorn's back.
Did not Arya or one of the Varden healers offer to remove this wheel? You should not have to carry it.
Arya did offer, but... Aragorn stopped, unable to articulate his feelings. Finally, he just said, It's part of me now, just as Murtag's scar is part of him.
Murtag's scar?
Murtag bore a similar mark. It was inflicted when his father Morzan threw Zarok at him, while he was only a child.
Oromus stared at him seriously for a long time, before he nodded and moved on. You have a fair amount of muscle, and you are not as lopsided as most swordsmen. Are you ambidextrous?
Not really, but I had to teach myself to fight with my left hand after I broke my wrist by Tirm.
Good. That will save some time. Clasp your hands behind your back and lift them as high as possible.
Aragorn did as he was told, but the posture hurt his shoulders and he could barely make his hands meet.
Now bend forward while keeping your knees straight. Try to touch the ground.
This was even harder for Aragorn. He ended up bowed like a hunchback, with his arms hanging uselessly by his head, while his hamstrings twinged and burned. His fingers were still 9 or 10 inches from the ground.
At least you can stretch without hurting yourself. I had not hoped for so much. You can perform a number of exercises for flexibility without overexerting.
Yes. Then Oromus addressed Saphira.
I would know your capabilities as well, dragon.
he gave her a number of complex poses that had her contort every foot of her sinuous length in fantastic ways, culminating in a series of aerial acrobatics the likes of which Aragorn had never seen before. Only a few things exceeded her ability, such as executing a backward loop while corkscrewing through the air. When she landed, it was Glaedah who said,
"I fear that we coddled the riders. If our hatchlings had been forced to care for themselves in the wild, as you were, and so our ancestors were, then perhaps they would have possessed your skill."
"No," said Aramis. "Even if Saphira had been raised on Vroengard using the established methods, she would still be an extraordinary flyer. I've rarely seen a dragon so naturally suited to the sky."
Saphira blinked, then shuffled her wings and busied herself cleaning one of her claws in a manner that hid her head from view.
"You have room to improve, as do we all, but little, very little."
The elf reseated himself, his back perfectly straight. For the next 5 hours, by Aragorn's reckoning, Aramis delved into every aspect of his and Saphira's knowledge, from botany to woodworking to metallurgy and medicine, although he mainly concentrated on their grasp of history and the ancient language. The interrogation comforted Aragorn, as it reminded him of how Brom used to quiz him during their long treks to Tirm and Dras Leona. When they broke for lunch, Aramis invited Aragorn into his house, leaving the two dragons alone. The elf's quarters were barren, except for those few essentials necessary for food, hygiene, and the pursuit of an intellectual life. Two entire walls were dotted with cubbyholes that held hundreds of scrolls. Next to the table hung a golden sheath, the same colour as Glaedah's scales, and a matching sword with a blade the colour of iridescent bronze. On the inner pane of the door, set within the heart of the wood, was a flat panel, one span high and two wide. It depicted a beautiful, towering city, built against an escarpment and caught in the ruddy light of a rising harvest moon. The pitted lunar face was bisected by the horizon, and appeared to sit on the ground like a maculated dome as large as a mountain. The picture was so clear and perfectly detailed, Aragorn at first took it to be a magical window. It was only when he saw that the image was indeed static that he could accept it as a piece of art. "Where is this?" he asked. Aramis's slanted features tightened for an instant.
"You would do well to memorize that landscape, Aragorn, for there lies the heart of your misery. You see what was once our city of Illyria. It was burned and abandoned during Dufirn's Gulblaka, and became the capital of the Brodring Kingdom, and now is the black city of Urubane. I made that Ferth on the night that I and others were forced to flee our home before Galbatorix arrived."
"You painted this Ferth?"
"No, no such thing. A Ferth is an image fixed by magic upon a square of polished slate that is prepared beforehand with layers of pigments. The landscape upon that door is exactly how Illyria presented itself to me at the moment I uttered my spell."
"And," said Aragorn, unable to stop the flow of questions, "what was the Brodring Kingdom?"
Aramis's eyes widened with dismay. "You don't know?" Aragorn shook his head. "How can you not? Considering your circumstances and the fear that Galbatorix wields among your people, I might understand that you were raised in darkness, ignorant of your heritage. But I cannot credit Brom with being so lax with your instruction as to neglect subjects that even the youngest elf or dwarf knows. The children of your Varden could tell me more about the past."
"Brom was more concerned with keeping me alive than teaching me about people who are already dead," retorted Aragorn. This drew silence from Aramis. Finally, he said,
"Forgive me. I did not mean to impugn Brom's judgment. Only I am impatient beyond reason. We have so little time, and each new thing you must learn reduces that which you can master during your tenure here."
He opened a series of cupboards hidden within the curved wall and removed bread rolls and bowls of fruit, which he wrote out on the table. He paused for a moment over the food with his eyes closed before beginning to eat.